You are listening to the Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia, brought to you by iWalkUp, flexible loans built for small businesses. Today, we are in Castelluccio.
Cozze ci tene cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora. Cozze ci tene cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, se non mangiano le femmine.
Where are we, Lionel?
We are in Castelluccio this afternoon at the end of the Giro's Stage 10 time trial, which set out from Amatrice. Is that right, Daniel?
Yeah, it's close enough.
Thank
it's
you.
Close enough.
And
just on the outskirts.
Well, you've had the whole rest day to revise it, decent fist of it, really.
God, that's almost... have you ever thought of being a teacher, maybe? You know, nurturing children
and
imparting knowledge.
It's in the blood.
Scarring them for life.
My parents trained as teachers. Yeah.
Anyway, time trial day and it being the Giro.
Well, no, sorry, Napalm. Just on where we're finishing today. We'll talk about the significance of it, the symbolism of it later. But Castelluccio, I don't know who was with me a couple of years ago when we were up at Gran Sasso d'Italia and the Campo Imperatore and the fabulous. There's a fantastic plateau up there in the Apennines, in Abruzzo, and it's known as the Small Tibet in Italian. Was it you, Napalm?
Yeah, that was the day of the Grande Casino on the cable car,
correct,
wasn't it?
Correct,
Poor old Giro was really out of his comfort zone, didn't like it in the cable car, didn't like having to queue for the cable car or get in
exactly,
it.
Well,
yeah, it was one of those days.
Today we're a bit north of there, but it's kind of similar. If you ever get the chance to go to Castelluccio, it's an incredible high plateau, and between mid-July, you get poppies and lentil flowers as well, and you'll see this incredible sort of technicolor display of flowers up there. And these pictures are often published in Italian newspapers around about that time of year, and they go around the world because it's quite a sight. So if ever anyone gets a chance to go up there around about that time of year, then do it.
By Giro standards, 39.8 kilometers is not an unreasonable time trial length, is it? But there's a big climb.
Of course there is.
Two-thirds of the way down the course,
it's
total
a beautiful
of 1,000
climb,
meters of climbing over
the Forca di Presta.
Just too much. I mean, you know, what are you trying to do to us?
Fantastic. So we start in the Lazio region today. We finish in Umbria and Napalm. That I mentioned them, Castelluccio, famous for its lentils, but when you get into that region, you get to close to Norcia, Gubbio, those places, fantastic black truffle. Which I know we mentioned yesterday, but you will be in your element. You'll be like a pig in truffle.
I'd like to cross the line at the end of the time trial and just sort of thrust my face into a basket full of truffles, like a hog, I suppose. Anyway, let's cross over to the course.
Not the best.
The hog of Watford. How is the hog of Watford getting on
the
climb?
The Cinghiale di Watford, the wild boar of Watford.
Well, this is a pretty hard time trial course. Shouldn't expect anything different in the Giro. There's a great big climb in the middle. I can sort of see the top. Well, I can't see the top, but it's there somewhere just ahead. And then I think it's downhill to the line. But this has been a really tough test, and I need proper transitional stages the next couple of days. Otherwise, I'm not going to make it to virtual Milan.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iwalker.co.uk. iwoca.co.uk.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, iWalker, an award-winning finance company specializing in lending to small businesses. They were founded in 2011 and have issued more than £1 billion to companies ranging from startups to established businesses. iWalker can lend between £1,000 and £250,000, and by making it quick and easy to apply for a loan and get a quick decision, it can be a more flexible option than approaching the big banks. iWalker also support cycling, of course. They sponsor the Kendall Cycle Club and the Cycling Podcast.
Amarcord. I remember...
Et puis Simeoni qui, cet extrait du peloton, a été accompagné par Lance Armstrong.
Never seen this. Simeoni looks over his shoulder and says, I can't believe it, I've got Lance Armstrong with me.
He allegedly told Simeoni that he had a lot of money and would destroy the Italian. Simeoni finished the stage fighting back tears. The incident remains one of the most emblematic moments of cycling's most painful epoch, and a memory that follows Filippo Simeoni everywhere. Stage 5 of this year's Giro d'Italia went through his hometown, Sezze. He was in Terracina that day, and it was there, in a bar overlooking the finish line, that he and I renewed our old acquaintance on Wednesday. It hurts me that I put together a good career, winning more than 10 races, including 2 Vuelta stages and that Tricolore jersey. And yet my image and my name are still only ever associated with the Armstrong incident. I don't really like that, to be honest, because for me it was a very unpleasant episode that damaged my career. I didn't gain anything from it, and in fact, I lost a lot. So no, I don't like being remembered for that. I'd like to be remembered as a guy who won important things, who was a decent rider, who could have won even more. I know that I have nothing to reproach myself for, either that day or when I testified against Ferrari. I know deep down that I was honest and that I was right, and other people also know that. I can hold my head high. I have no skeletons in my closet. But on the other hand, I realise that in the society that we live in, people who put up a facade, who are good actors, thrive, whereas honest, straight talkers are often cast aside. That's the regret I have, but it doesn't matter. I'm just happy to have made an important contribution, and perhaps, in a few years, when I'm no longer around, that contribution will be recognised. I've got 2 sons, one's 16, one's 9. The 16-year-old inherited my love of cycling and also races, without any pressure from me or huge ambition to achieve anything. He just does it out of passion. I'm happy about that because, fundamentally, it's a healthy sport that can instil good values, help a kid to grow and form their character. But yes, he knows what happened, because kids today can find out anything on the internet. I also watched it back with him on YouTube, although he didn't particularly quiz me about it. He'll have formed his own opinion, and I left him to that. Also because I don't feel particularly comfortable talking to him about it.
So chaps, that was a little clip from our Kilometer Zero last year. I met up with Filippo Simeoni near his house in Sezze, which is in Lazio. The time trial today starts in Amatrice, which is just in Lazio, and we're going to finish in Umbria. And yeah, as I said earlier, it's an homage to the victims of the terrible earthquake that took place there over several months. Well, there were several. There were several sort of earthquakes and aftershocks that took place between August 2016 and early 2017. And again, much like yesterday, we talked about the L'Aquila earthquake. You know, the legacy of that disaster is still very much being felt in those regions, some rural communities where people lost their homes and livelihoods. And unfortunately, it's a bit of a theme of life in that region of all those parts of central Italy, or has been over the last few decades. Very regular earthquakes, often we don't hear about them, they're not reported internationally, but there's an awful lot of seismic activity. Seismic, is that the right pronunciation?
If it's not somebody seismic? Will correct you.
Seismic,
you don't,
no.
You don't have to be an seismic. Astrologer seismic. To forecast that. But that's going back a few days.
The errors accumulate over about 12 stages, don't they? People really start to see the holes in our...
Yeah, astrologist, yeah. Of course, not astrologer. Anyway, yeah. What are we talking about today, Lionel? It's time trial day, so we've got a very appropriate subject.
We have. We're going back to 2013 and the time trial, which went from Gabice Mare to Saltara. It was a Stage 8 time trial. And if you cast your mind back to 2013, the Giro really kind of stepped up a level in the consciousness of British cycling fans, I think, because Bradley Wiggins was going into the race as the Tour de France champion and with the stated aim of trying to add the Giro. And, well, the things went wrong and then wronger for Wiggins, didn't they, as the race unfolded. And well, that was him done and dusted, really, as a Grand Tour contender. But the day was won by Alex Dowsett, another British rider who was riding with the Movistar team. Dowsett had had a couple of years with Team Sky and had been frustrated not to get an opportunity to ride a Grand Tour. So this was his first Giro d'Italia, his first Grand Tour of any type. And he set the early time, and then he had a long afternoon waiting to see whether the time would be enough to win the stage. And I thought we would review the day and that Giro in particular, and what it was like racing for the Movistar team that year. And just before our Giro began, I got him on the phone and we had a good chat.
Can I just say one thing before we cross over to Alex Dowsett about that? Because, I mean, it's a fascinating interview, and especially what he tells us about that day in particular. It was supposed to be Bradley Wiggins' big day. But I do remember going to see him at the Classics that year, his first year with Movistar. And, you know, he wasn't a Classics rider. And it showed sort of how threadbare the Movistar Classics options were. But he'd been thrown into the Classics. And if you look at his build up to that Giro, he rode one time trial at Tirreno Adriatico back in March. But, you know, in the, you know, 6 weeks or so before the Giro, he rode, you know, Dwarsdorf-Vlaanderen, Gent-Wevelgem, Tour Flanders, Paris-Roubaix, all the classics, finished very few of them. In fact, he only finished Skelderpries of all of them. So his preparation for the Giro was remarkably poor from a racing point of view, which makes his result on the day all the more astonishing, really.
What do you remember about the course that day, Daniel, or the region that time trial took place in? It was 54.8 kilometres, and it had a little bit of climbing in it, not quite as much as our Giro today, but still a true test for the time trialists and for the GC riders.
Yeah, well, it's a very hilly part of Italy. It's sort of Tirreno Adriatico country, so a lot of very steep short climbs there, and I suppose, you know, another thing that really makes that result even more impressive is that with a 54 kilometer time trial in the Giro, that would have sort of got the antenna of the stage race specialists who were also, well, time trialists, and that would have got their antenna buzzing, you know, when the route was announced. And you know, the Giro would have attracted and did attract some really good time trialists that year, because, you know, as we know, that the Grand Tour riders and those with ambitions to win Grand Tours, you know, that's one of the main criteria on which they base their choice. You know, if I'm a time trialist, I go to the race with the longest time trials, and a 54 kilometer time trial is by modern standards very, very long. So to have beaten all of the specialists that day was quite some feat.
Well, let's hear from Alex. There were 201 riders in that time trial. He was 163rd on GC going into the time trial stage, so what's that, 37 riders had gone off before him. And well, we'll hear from Alex, and then we'll probably take a little break for lunch, and then we'll hear some more from Alex in the second part of the podcast.
I think probably still one of the most successful Neo Pro years that team's had. Well, the second year, I was told that I would have a Grand Tour and it would be the Giro. And then I think, you know, through me, there was Wiggins, there was G, there was all these, you know, Grand Tour contenders, and it was a case of taking a Neo Pro to a Grand Tour was deemed a risk, and they weren't going to take a risk. It sort of cited lack of experience above anything else. So to me, it was like, right, where do I go to get that experience? And Movistar, I had a few options at the end of my contract, and Movistar was the one team that actively said, like, we want you and this is our plan for you. And I felt very wanted there. So I went, and the plan was the Giro, and I was thrown straight into it, which was pretty eye-opening. And then stage 8 happened.
Alex Dowsett, 24enne inglese della Movistar, seguito a saltare da madre, compagna e famiglia, si gode come ieri ad Amundsen la giornata più bella della carriera, con la differenza che, essendo assai più giovane, ha la concreta speranza di viverne molte altre. Come
Nibali, well, just roll back a little bit there. What was eye-opening about it? I mean, the start was in Napoli. I mean, it's a pretty striking city, isn't it? Right down in the south, I'm sports mad, certainly football mad. Was it what you expected the Giro to be?
No. I kind of went in there, I was a blasé young pro. I didn't expect it, like, even stage one, to be as hard as it was. It was like, I knew I'd upped my game for the Giro, but everyone had. It's like guys that I was racing against in sort of some of the classics and you know, things like Tirreno. It's like I'd raised my level for a Grand Tour, but so had everyone. So I felt like I hadn't moved forwards at all. I wasn't in Grand Tour shape or wasn't in a better place for this year. I was simply in the same place as everyone else. It's just that everyone had raised their game by a couple of percent. So like, even that first 2 or 3 hour crit round Napoli was hard. And I remember coming out of it thinking, like, God, I've got 3 weeks of this.
And then the next day was a team time trial and, a really excellent result for your team. All eyes really were on Bradley Wiggins, of course, the Tour de France champion from the previous year. And he'd made a big thing, or the team had made a big thing about going to the Giro, hoping to win it. But for your team to get, I think, 9 seconds, was that right, behind Team Sky in the team time trial? I mean, how did that day go?
Yeah, I remember it being biblically difficult because Movistar sort of, they attack a team time trial. I think that was our strength. That's why we did so well, is we just kind of attacked it. But that meant a bunch of climbers and me attacking these climbs. And I just remember it being, I was really struggling to hang on, especially up the last climb. But yeah, I mean, I was into, I wore the white jersey the day after, actually, stage three, because Salvatore Puccio he was in the leader's jersey, but he was leading the young rider's jersey, and I ended up being second young rider. So I was in the white jersey for a day, which was the year that Paul Smith had designed it as well. And yeah, it was pretty crazy. Had Paul Smith came to the team bus sort of that day and sort of shouted my name for me to come out. And yeah, just you sort of realise you're in the big time then.
And what did you make of Italy? I mean, you'd have raced in Italy. You'd as an under 23 as well, I guess. Was there something? You know, we're talking about the recent past here, but was there anything about Italy and racing in Italy that felt any different to anywhere else?
You couldn't really compare riding the Giro to riding the under 23. Sort of amateur scene in Italy, because it just, a Grand Tour is so much bigger in every aspect. Like the crowds, the way that every town just shuts down and embraces the race. It's it'd always be quite, it'd be odd when we'd go to, I think we climbed up the roads that we did in Capodarco, which was a famous under 23 Italian race that Pete Kenyuk won. It was kind of surreal because I was like, okay, I wonder how fast we're going up this climb now compared to what we would do in the under 23s. But yeah, just, you know, just how the public embraced it was always very cool. You really felt you were part of something quite spectacular.
And the 2 or 3 days before the time trial, which came towards the end of the first week, didn't it? I think it was, there was still one more stage before a rest day, but you're getting a week of a Grand Tour in your legs. I mean, how were you feeling on sort of stage six, stage seven?
That's okay. I mean, I was tired. Yeah, I was tired, but I was okay. I can't really remember anything significant. So I think nothing gave me a huge amount of trouble. Nothing really scared me until the final week of the Giro. I coped with everything okay, and we had that stage seven, which was the stage Adam Hansen won, which the profile was like a sawtooth. It was like, yeah, sawtooth profile, lots of short sharp climbs. And it rained, and we'd done a very similar stage in Tirreno that year, where I think actually the Gruppetto ended up walking up a climb, and I had I'd exceeded my own expectations by still being in kind of a group that was still racing up with 20k to go. I kind of joked because Tyler Farrar was still there, and he looked at me, he was like, "What are you still doing here?" And I said exactly the same thing back to him, and we laughed. But I remember because Wiggins crashed on that stage, and so did I. I just remember slipping off on one of the final downhills and I was sliding backwards on my backside. I had Hayden Ralston riding towards me, and whilst I was sliding, he sort of asked me if I was okay, and I was like, yeah, I'm all right. Waited until the barrier collected me and then jumped back up and carried on.
Hansen leads up front, and the row, the riders, there's big gaps between them. Let's get another shot of this, and Sella just pushing too hard. Oh, and frustration. The only thing you will say about this is that there's so little group on the roads that the riders will slide a bit, and there isn't quite the same amount of road rash, but that doesn't mean it doesn't hurt.
No, but Sella seems to be sliding out very, very easily there. And, you know, there's a lot of the other riders getting around there, and, you know, Hansen is going down at the same rate. I don't know, is it his tyres or is he just panicking in the corner? And if you panic and you go too heavy on the brakes.
Riders down once more, and they're falling like nine pins at the moment. Bradley Wiggins is down once more, and this, well, he has been looking perhaps a little bit nervous, and he hasn't been enjoying this stage, you can be sure about it, and a little bit slow to get going here. He's well outside the 3 kilometre point, to remember, so he needs to try and get back on terms with the overall contenders.
So then the time trial stage 8, was there a sense from the team that, you know, okay Alex, this is your day, and for yourself, was there a sense that you'd missed the Grand Tour at Team Sky, and this was a real chance to shine? I mean, how were you feeling when you woke up and on the way to the stage and all of that?
No, none of that. I'd say it was, I think very much Movistar had said the aim for the Giro was just to get through it. There was no pressure on me at all. It was, they treat it like, okay, here's a race you're doing. There was zero pressure whatsoever for that TT, for anything. And it was nice actually, because my teammate Ben Yatton Chousty was in the pink jersey for the TT. So it's kind of, there was a lot of focus on him. Yeah, I mean, I'd spoken to Wiggins a couple of days prior to the time trial, and he'd said that whoever won it, it was going to be like a win by minutes rather than seconds. The gaps were going to be big because of how hard and long it was. He sort of told me he'd recce'd it and sort of been out and ridden it and whatnot, and I hadn't. I had no idea. I was going into it very blind. I sort of went about it like I would do any other TT really, which as a youngster wasn't as professional, say, as I would attack a time trial now.
So there wasn't even an opportunity to recce the course in the morning or go round in a team car or sort of piggyback onto Inchowski's preps for the stage? It was just basically roll up to the start house and away you go.
So what I did do a bit of homework because I hadn't seen the course at all. We were sponsored by SRM at the time, and I had in my kit bag a Garmin, one of the older Garmin 800s with a map function. And I asked the mechanics to tape up the logos and put my Garmin just next to my SRM on my handlebars. So I had a lot of screens in front of me. But what I'd done is I'd put the, you know, something that we do a lot now, but I put the map in the Garmin map so that I could see all the corners in the first 25K. Because the first 25K, the course was, it was split into three parts. The first 25K, the second 25K, and then kind of a 3K climb up to the finish. And the first 25K was very up and down, very twisty, very turny, a lot of hairpins, a lot of fast corners. And it helped to know it. And I was like, well, I don't know it, so what's the next best thing? And that was putting it in my maps so I could, kind of like a rally driver, see the corner before I get there. So I had that, and the team turned a blind eye, thankfully, to the fact that there was a Garmin on my handlebars. I got to ride the first 13 kilometres of it in the morning, but because it was point to point, we couldn't get all the way to the finish. And then there was like, do you want to do 55K before doing a 55K TT in the middle of a Grand Tour? So yeah, and the second 25K was pretty simple. It was just long straight sections. It wasn't too complicated. So that's sort of the homework I did for it, I guess.
And I think, well, I've counted up, you were the 44th rider off, so probably in the first, what would that make it, hour and a half, I guess, if it was a couple of minute intervals.
It's just 1 minute intervals.
1 minute interval, so right, yeah. So there you go. And I mean, a few sort of time trialists' names kind of jump out at me who'd gone off before you, but at various different stages of their career. So, but you know, David Miller, Jack Bobridge, who else? Swain Tuft. When you were going, you were off, and you mentioned about how winning by minutes. I mean, it was close at the top end, but
yeah.
I think only 13 riders got within 2 minutes of you. So when you set off and you're getting time, were you getting any time information as you were going around, or were you just, was it just focusing on your performance and the feel of that performance?
Well, the funny thing is, I was still very new to Spanish, and the team radio and behind was all in Spanish. So it was, I think I was very much doing my own thing. But at the first intermediate, so Taylor Finney had started 3 minutes ahead of me. I had no clue how I was going. I mean, I knew the power was quite good, like it wasn't bad. My heart rate wasn't coming up, but that's kind of expected given it was stage eight of a Grand Tour. Not that I knew this at the time, because it was my first Grand Tour, but I was like struggling to get my heart rate over 160, which normally in a TT should be in the 180s, but kind of just plodded on. And I got to the first intermediate, so after the technical section, and the team came down the radio to tell me that I was a minute and a half ahead of Taylor Finney. Now, I translated that as a minute and a half. And when they'd said 30 segundo, I sort of, in my head, whilst on my limit, translated that as like, it's a minute and a half, like I'm in second position and a minute and a half behind Taylor Finney. And I remember thinking, Christ, he's flying. And I thought, well, maybe I should just shut this down now and ride steady to the finish, just save it, because we've still got two-thirds of a Grand Tour to do. And I thought, actually, as Avio's in the car behind, he's the big boss. I've never shut down a time trial before this point, so now's not the time to start. We'll just soldier on to the end, full tilt. And then I remember I got another kind of 15K up the road, and I see a BMC team car. And my initial thought was like, there's no, I know Adam Blythe is no time trialist, but there is no way I've caught him for 14 minutes. And if I have, he's in trouble for time cut by a long way. And then as I got closer, I saw that it was a very tall Adam Blythe. And I thought, oh, nah, that's Taylor. And then I was like, oh, you must be a minute and a half ahead. That's what the Spanish means for that. So then just sort of powered on, and over passed Taylor for 3 minutes and carried on to the finish. And it was it's difficult, I think, because if something like that was to happen now, I would be far more ecstatic about it than I was then, because I was just kind of, it was still so new and so unfamiliar, and I kind of didn't give the Grand Tours the credit they deserve in terms of their stature and significance. And I was just like, oh yeah, like I'm leading the stage of a Grand Tour so far, this is cool. But there's some big hitters, including Wiggins, to come, and Wiggins has told me basically that he or someone is going to win by minutes, so like the big boys are coming soon. See what happens.
So what was the protocol back then? Was there the kind of the hot seat that we're more familiar with now? Had they started doing that? What did you do once you crossed the line?
You go sit in the hot seat and you wait. I'm not sure I ate anything. I mean, I probably had a recovery drink. But my mum, dad and sister were there, which was pretty cool. Mum, bless her, got awfully confused and cheered on a Team Sky rider on the final climb, thinking it was me. She clean forgot that I'd moved teams through that sort of fleeting moment. But yeah, just sat and waited and watched them come in, and I think it was a good 2.5 hours or something absurd, where we were just waiting. You kind of got used to seeing where someone was at the bottom of the final climb and then how long it was going to take them to get to the top. So you could kind of predict when they were going to come in and what times. I got a few scares, like Nibali, I think, went through the first technical section faster than I did, which gave me a fright. But then my coach at the time, Xavier Arteche, messaged me and said, don't worry, he'll slow down on the long straight bits, which he did. Yeah, and then obviously, I mean, the main ones we were waiting for was Nibali and Wiggins, really.
Kangert is at the first intermediate split. Wiggins is out on course. Dowsett leads in the early stages. Bradley Wiggins negotiates another downhill left-hand hairpin and works his way immediately into a very, very bumpy right-hander as he's managing to stay upright and is really scything his way through the field. He's passed several of the riders that started ahead of him already. Danilo De Luca, Sergio Henao, Wilco Kelderman have made way for Wiggins as he is powering around this course, chasing the time, the benchmark time set by the early leader, Alex Dowsett, a man from Essex.
The Cycling Podcast at Our Giro d'Italia is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport, our longest standing supporters, all the way back to 2016. And you can get 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code Daniel.
Seismic activity.
Very close. SISCP25. Remember that, Daniel, because I will test you again in another few days. SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. And speaking of fueling...
Well, speaking of fueling, that's lunch, isn't it, chaps? And Daniel, we started our time trial in Amatrice this morning. We're in the Rome region of Italy. Two great pasta dishes, aren't they? Which are you, Team Carbonara or Team Amatriciana?
It'd have to be Amatriciana. I don't really like... we've talked about this before, haven't we? I have this deep, implicit mistrust of anyone who likes eggs, anyone who eats eggs. And although, you know, when they're sort of mixed in, as they are in carbonara, that doesn't really pose me any...
No eggs in carbonara, Daniel. Just double cream.
Oh, God.
Ham and mushrooms.
Well, let's...
Yes,
delicious.
Richard.
And some onions.
Oh dear. Beautiful. Let's get the definitive from.
Well, anyway, Napalm, I was going to say that, yeah, Amatriciana, but both sort of Roman dishes associated with Rome, and Rome in Italy is a bit of a, it's kind of the bastard child of Italian cuisine, not really noted for its great food. Although there are quite a lot of famous Roman dishes. Saltimbocca is another one.
Well, let's get the definitive on both carbonara and amatriciana from Felicity Cloak, award-winning food writer for The Guardian and the author of One More Croissant for the Road. And, well, she definitely knows what goes in both dishes.
Il ristorante.
So, carbonara and amatriciana, which I'm almost certainly saying wrong, I'm going to disclosure here, that's because I am not the biggest fan of amatriciana. I'm definitely team carbonara. They're both actually very simple dishes. Amatriciana is from the Abruzzo, although it's now very commonly found in Rome, brought by immigrants from the Abruzzo. And carbonara is more of a Roman speciality. They're both very, very, like many Italian classics, simple dishes that would have been made with what was to hand. The legend is that carbonara was created by charcoal burners in the hills above Rome with the stuff that they used to take out on their sort of charcoal burning expeditions with them. So traditionally it contains dried pasta, eggs, guanciale, which is sort of cured pork cheeks, or there you can use, if you're not Roman, you can use any kind of cured pork, really, and cheese, either pecorino romano or parmesan, or I think a mixture of both, and all tossed together, and lots of black pepper. I cleave to the belief that the carbonara name actually comes from all the black pepper, looks a bit like charcoal, but that is disputed. Amatriciana is... again, it's got the guanciale, the cured pork cheek, But instead of the eggs, it's got tomatoes, and then it's got pecorino cheese again. So very simple. Carbonara is generally, although not always, served with spaghetti. You also find it with penne and other shapes. Amatriciana is generally served with bucatini, which is another of my problems with it, because bucatini is that sort of long spaghetti-like pasta, but it's hollow in the centre. And so when you sort of suck up pieces of it, you end up kind of whistling and sucking up air as well and looking faintly ridiculous. So I think that that's mostly my beef with it. They're both delicious dishes, but I'm going to go with the carbonara. That's my team.
Now, these are two dishes that should be made with guanciale, but I was only able to source some pancetta in the supermarkets during lockdown. But I think that's an authentic enough substitution. Both very simple dishes. The amatriciana obviously has the chili flakes in it, giving it a little bit of a kick. The carbonara was, it was delicious. Mixing the cheese with the egg yolks and keeping that warm over the pasta water and then stirring the pasta into the egg yolk. That was the bit of the technique that I had to kind of learn, and the bit that was a mystery to me before. How do you get that kind of glossy sheen on the pasta? And the mix of the bacon, the salty bacon and the egg was absolutely perfect. So for me, the carbonara wins. But what do you reckon, just for using your eyes to judge the two dishes?
I mean, visually, I'm going to say, unfortunately, the amatriciana, I don't know how you managed this, but it sort of looked a bit like a hairball of pasta. But I will say that on a positive note, you've managed to get a good sauce coverage, and the pancetta looked delicious. So it's just a slightly unfortunate presentation. And the carbonara, I think, could have been stronger if it hadn't collapsed. It's got a bit of a Roman ruin look to it as it is. It's sort of spread out on the plate. But I thought that for me, that was also the winner. It looked really... had that lovely golden colour from the egg yolks, and there were no bits of scrambled egg in there, which is obviously the risk with carbonara, that you end up cooking the egg too much. And I couldn't, hard as I tried, Lionel, I could not detect any bits of scrambled egg.
Wiggins hits the hills and gets the roars of support. He's got 52 seconds to close on Alex Dowsett. Alex Dowsett, of course, is not a general classification contender, so from Wigan's point of view, it's all about how he does against the other GC guys. But there will be a level of concern there, because even though he knows that Alex Dowsett is a top time trialist and a man who's really coming into his form, still he knows that perhaps with his reputation and his palmarès that he ought to be able to beat Dowsett, so one would suggest that that's going to be his target time. So these perhaps worrying moments, he'll be made aware of his deficit at the first intermediate split point, and it's how he reacts. Well, that's going to be the big question for Bradley Wiggins. Of course, not knowing the other, you know, because he's not starting last or close to the end, he doesn't have the advantage of knowing what the other general classifications are doing out on course. Vincenzo Nibali will, though, because there's only one man to start after him. Just 5 seconds on overall classification time between himself and Benyat Inshousti. And could this be the time that Nibali from Sicily finally provides for Italy in the Giro d'Italia?
So when Wiggins came, because he was a little bit down on GC compared to where he probably wanted to be. I think Nibali going into the stage was second on GC,
yes.
So he may well have been the last man to actually cross the line if he caught Inshousti. I'm not sure whether he did or not, but with Wiggins coming in, I mean, 10 seconds counting down from I don't know what sort of kilometre out, you must have been slightly heart in mouth, because it's not a huge margin, is it? It's close enough for to cause a bit of discomfort.
I think at the bottom of the climb, I had sort of 55 seconds on Wiggins. If the race had finished at the bottom, it would have been a comfortable win. But it didn't. And Wiggins flew up that final climb. And, yeah, suddenly came, you know, I think we sort of saw with the 500 and 400 meter marks, I was like, I think I'm quite sure I've still got this to Wiggins, which was, that was a real, I think it was when Wiggins crossed the line, I thought, okay, maybe. Yeah, I remember, because Wiggins crossed the line around a similar time to Nibali going through the first intermediate. So a bit like beating Wiggins, I was like, Christ, I might actually have this. And then Nibali crossed the line and it was like, okay, don't count your chickens yet, because Nibali's up on you at the first intermediate.
So here comes Bradley Wiggins. Will he be able to beat the time of Alex Dowsett? It looks like it's going to be a little bit beyond him. Here comes, they're clocking down the time, and Alex Dowsett will be thrilled and relieved that he lasts a little bit longer. But still, it's an impressive performance by Bradley Wiggins as he heads across the finish line to complete the individual time trial. Second fastest to the time of Alex Dowsett. So good effort from Bradley Wiggins, and quite a bit closer indeed than he was through the first intermediate split after taking a bike change after that early puncture.
The team were hilarious, because up until that point, since Movistar had started sponsoring Abarca Sports, they'd at least won a stage of every single Grand Tour that they'd partaken in. And I had effectively fulfilled this quota for the 2013 Giro. And, you know, the team doctor was like, that evening, he's like, do you want to go home? I looked at him and I said, what do you mean? He says, why? You've won a stage. You don't need to finish now. You can just go home if you like. And so I was like, oh no, this is still my first Grand Tour. Like, I want to get round. And he's like, oh, okay. Well, but you know, if you do want to go home, just let us know. I was like, this is surreal.
Did it cross your mind at all? I mean, you know, it must be quite, well, the Giro traditionally, in certainly in the last decade or so, and probably has always been the one where, you know, the last week tends to be brutally hard. And I think that year was no different. There was never a moment when you thought, well, look, I've ticked off a stage win. I will save myself. There was a determination to get to the finish.
Yeah, and that came from within. But like I said, Movistar never put any pressure on me to do anything in that race at all. It was very much like, this is just another race. And we had a real cool team there, where I think Visconti won two stages, Inchausti won a stage, wore the pink jersey, I wore the white jersey, Visconti I think won the King of the Mountains jersey. We did very well as a team there. And so it was a lot of fun to be a part of. And I only remember there was only one moment through the whole race where I thought, I'm in trouble with not finishing here. And that was early on in the final week. And I was out the back with Jesse Sargent, and we were just both chopping off at sort of 450, 500 watts, trying to stay within touch until the bunch calmed down, and then just kind of got into a safe place and rode it in with the gruppetto. I was very proud I finished, because that was to me, as at the time, that was as significant as winning the stage, mostly because I didn't really understand the significance of winning a stage of a Grand Tour. I mean, it's 2020 and we're still talking about it. Yeah, I mean, Geraint Thomas sent me a message. Like, Geraint and I we'd not, our amateur paths hadn't, we weren't on the academy together. We hadn't, our paths hadn't crossed much, and we hadn't raced much together in Sky. We were always on different race programs, but he sent me a message out of the blue, and just, it was a congratulatory message in a typical Geraint Thomas fashion, which was like, I've done 108 Grand Tour stages and never won one, and you've managed to do it in 8. Like, well done, but also like something sarcastic, I think. It was surreal, but it's like I said, I didn't really understand how significant it was until as the years went on, and it sort of, people keep saying like, but you are a Grand Tour stage winner, like you've won a stage of a Grand Tour, and not an insignificant, yeah, 55k time trial is not an insignificant one to win. There's no luck to it. Yeah, it's
switching to sort of like the Italian aspect of it. I mean, you were riding Pinarello bikes that year, weren't you? I mean, did things like that matter to the riders? The fact you're, I mean, Pinarello is it's one of the marquee names of Italian cycling, isn't it? I mean, and there are so many, you know, Colnago, Cinelli, all of the clothing and equipment brands, Campagnolo, Santini, and so on. I mean, the list goes on. But does that make any difference to you as a rider? The fact that you were riding on an Italian brand?
No, not really. I mean, actually, I was quite frustrated with the Pinarello situation because Sky were on Pinarello as well, and it was a twofold thing. I was on Pinarello at Team Sky as well as in Movistar, but we had a handlebar sponsor. And Team Sky, for the old Pinarello Graal, Team Sky had recognised that the integrated handlebars just weren't good enough. So they'd gone about their own way to make their own bars, which were like similar to what you used to see on the Team GB Track UK Sports Institute track bars, which were phenomenal. And then went to Movistar, and because they had a handlebar sponsor, which I think was Vision, the original Graal integrated bars were taken off and something worse was put on. So I felt from Sky to Movistar, I'd actually taken a backward step in how good my TT bike was. And then on top of that, I think Sky had worked with Pinarello on the Bolide, and that had just come out. And we were looking at, and it was the last year that Movistar, 13 years Movistar were with Pinarello, and that was the last year. And I think, we looked at what Sky were using in terms of time trial bikes, this Bolide, and I had a Graal with cables flying out everywhere and just aerodynamically not good at all. And we're like, how are we a world tour team who wins, I think they won best team a few years running that time, or certainly when I was with them they were best team every year bar one. I was like, how have we got the same bike sponsor as Team Sky, yet we are on far inferior bikes? And it was like, Wiggins punched in that TT. And a lot of people are like, oh, yeah, well, he lost more than 10 seconds due to that puncture. And I was like, hang about. Let's have a look at his bike compared to mine. And knowing what we know now about aerodynamics, that's not insignificant. So, I mean, it's fine. I won. But if we're nitpicking, then let's look at the bike.
So here's confirmation of the finishing order of the Stage 8 time trial. Alex Tauset takes his first Grand Tour stage victory ahead of his fellow countryman Bradley Wiggins. Just 10 seconds between them. Tanel Kangert with a surprise but very impressive third place for the Astana squad. Just 14 seconds behind. Vincenzo Nibali, though, will be thrilled to just trade 11 seconds to Bradley Wiggins, finishing fourth overall ahead of Clement Durbridge. Cadel Evans, good performance for him in seventh place. Less than 40 seconds behind Tauset and less than half a minute behind Evans. Manuele Boaro came up with a good one, as we half expected. Sergio Henao, that was a great time trial performance for him, within a minute of the winner. Michele Scarponi too will be satisfied with his afternoon's work.
Have you spent a lot of time in Italy away from racing? Was the academy based there when you were when you were that age? And have you ever, I don't know, gone and stayed with anyone in Italy for sort of a mini training camp or whatever?
No, I stayed with Cav for a couple of weeks after I broke my collarbone before I did the hour record.
I'd
say it was the first time I actually got to enjoy Italy, because the academy, it wasn't an enjoyment. It was a sort of 2.5 summers of training camp in close confinement with guys that you were racing with but also against. It was a really tough environment to exist in, and you did not appreciate the environment you were in at all. Those were some of the hardest years of my career, I'd say, and not necessarily through the bike riding. And also the Rod Ellingworth school of training back then, there was not much variation in terms of the roads you did. If you were doing this day, you were doing it not on these roads. If you were doing these efforts, you were doing it on these roads. And it was always very much the same, whether it be Manchester or Italy. So we didn't really go exploring much, which, you know, now it's, you're sort of, now if you're on a 5-hour ride, you're desperately trying to find roads that you've never done before. So, yeah, no, I never been to Italy on holiday. So yeah, never had the chance to take it in for sort of the... So my sister went to Italy on her honeymoon, and I'm like, why? But I think all of my memories of Italy involved a lot of hard work and some pretty biblical climbs.
Well, Alex Dowsett there remembering perhaps his biggest success, I suppose, as our record as well would come into the reckoning. But really some fascinating detail there from Alex about the day and his, you know, failure to recce the course. Not failure on his part, but just, you know, the attention to detail at Movistar, and for him not perhaps what it might have been in other teams. And, you know, the equipment side of it, very interesting too. The fact that he maybe didn't really appreciate or realize at the time just what a big deal winning a stage of a Grand Tour was. So really fascinating, but also fascinating that day, of course, because as you said earlier on, Lionel, that was really the last of Bradley Wiggins as a Grand Tour contender. It was the last Grand Tour he ever rode. A few weeks later, he still had a knee problem, but he was quite controversially omitted from the Team Sky team for the Tour de France, and he was the defending champion, of course. So that was a huge bit of news at the time. And there's a sort of echo of that now in 2020 with if the Tour de France happens this year, Egan Bernal would go as defending champion, and the young kind of star on Team Ineos, and Chris Froome as the four-time winner would, as Bernal said the other day, be expected to ride in a supporting role. And it's clear that Froome is not very happy about this. I think that's become clear over the last few days. And there's even talk of him moving teams. He's out of contract at the end of the year, but some talk of a mid-season transfer. Can't see Team Ineos allowing that. But the parallels with 2013 are very striking, aren't they? Because there's once again a sort of lack of sentiment here. You know, there's no sort of real, it doesn't seem like there's an awful lot of sentiment around Froome and whether he deserves to go back to the Tour in a sort of leader's position. It's all about who's, you know, got the best chance of winning the race, obviously.
Well, what goes round comes around in professional sport, doesn't it? One day you're the coming man, and then a few days later, in the grand scheme of things, you're the fading force. And one thing that Team Sky, now Team Ineos, has always done is they've selected without any sentiment. As you say, Rich, they have gone with whoever will give them the best opportunity of winning the race. And even when there's been this kind of hedging of bets publicly, you've always had a sense that they know exactly what they're doing when it comes to who has priority and how they're going to play things on the road. And if you were looking at it from a distance, even given the additional recovery time that Froome has to come back from that terrible crash wrecking the time trial course at the Dauphiné last June, you know, he's had very, very little competition, only a few days at the UAE Tour in February before racing came to a halt. And so if you were just looking at it purely on who's the better bet, surely Egan Bernal is the better bet now and next year, just as Chris Froome was the better bet in July 2013. So it's not like it's without precedent, is it?
I suppose the other thing to consider, chaps, is the relative value of Froome to, well, both Ineos and a new team. I mean, it strikes me that he would almost be worth more to a new team than he would be to Ineos. And his price, you know, he would justify almost a higher contract to a new team purely, you know, on the basis of the kind of publicity, the mileage that could be acquired from signing him. You know, if he does stay, if he just signs another contract renewal at Ineos, it's more of the same. You know, he's probably not going to be as strong as he was two or three years ago. But If he did go to, for example, a Bahrain, they've been mooted, or in Israel, then, you know, it's a huge story whether he goes on to succeed and thrive or not. And, you know, he and Ineos and whichever team is interested in signing him, they'll be thinking in those terms, you know, how much bang are they going to get for their buck?
Talking of bang for buck, I mean, I'm not indulging in a conspiracy theory here, but, you know, cycling is not in the sports pages very much at the moment, is it? There's no racing going on. Teams are all desperate for some coverage for their sponsors. I mean, you know, it's generated some headlines for cycling. It could just be a big ruse to create a bit of interest and intrigue.
When I heard about the links with Bahrain McLaren, I just thought my mind immediately across the Basque Country and poor old Mikel Landa.
Poor old Landa.
The other thing there, though, is that the Bahrain McLaren riders have all taken pay cuts, haven't they? And I wonder how they would feel if it was true that the team was in negotiations to sign Chris Froome, presumably on a multi-million-pound contract. I can't see Team Ineos allowing him to leave in order to ride the Tour de France for another team this year. There's too much risk in that. For all that Froome will be 35 and that he's coming back from a very serious crash last year, there's nothing really... They don't need the money. There's nothing really for them to gain. A more likely scenario to me is that Froome is left out of the team for the Tour de France, which would be an even worse outcome for him, I would think, than going there ostensibly in support of Egan Bernal, given that anything can happen to a Grand Tour contender once the race starts. This is all speculation, isn't it, to some extent? But it does seem to be the case. I mean, like I say, the parallels with 2013 are very striking indeed. And it was and will always end this way, I think, for... You know, in 10 years, it'll be Egan Bernal. If the team's still around, there'll be someone else, and Egan Bernal will be forced out the door somehow.
And just with hindsight, Rich, thinking back to 2013, I think it probably struck us then, and if you'd asked us then, we would have said the same thing, but it certainly strikes me now with hindsight that Wiggins and the Giro d'Italia were always going to be a difficult, an uncomfortable fit, because, you know, the Giro is a race, I think, that's more difficult to control than the Tour de France. The riders are less familiar with the roads. The roads are not, I mean, the international riders, the roads are not as good in a lot of cases. There are more climbs, there are more climbs that don't appear or aren't obvious on the road book. And it tends to be a race that sort of suits a sort of feline kind of reactive rider who isn't riding to a well-defined plan necessarily. And it's in total contrast to the way that Sky Road and Wiggins won the 2013 Tour de France. They turned it into, you know, basically a long time trial. I mean, I'm sure anyone involved at Sky listening to that would think that was blasphemous, but that was certainly how it looked from the outside.
Well, in that 2013 Giro, Sky and Wiggins did well in the team time trial. They won it, and Wiggins had a very good day in the time trial. All right, he didn't win it, but it was still a good ride. It was when it was wet. It was when it was, you know, gnarly. He didn't like the descents very much. You know, they were the days that gave him the difficulties and put him right on the back foot, weren't they? So,
Lionel,
yeah, you're right.
Speaking of team time trials, Lionel, we've got something else coming up this week, haven't we, from the team time trial in the following year's Giro, 2014.
Oh, we have indeed, yeah. Mitch Docker's Life in the Peloton will be released on Wednesday for anyone who remembers the 2014 Giro. Started in Belfast and then had a stage that finished in Dublin before they transferred back to Italy, and the Orica Green Edge team won the team time trial on that Friday evening in Belfast. Svein Tuft had the pink jersey. Mitch Docker was part of that team, and they had a heck of a first week or so, because they defended the pink jersey when it transferred to the shoulders of their teammate Michael Matthews, who Matthews then won another stage. So they had a real eventful week, and he has got that band of brothers back together. He's spoken to as many of his teammates as he can for a sort of oral history of the 2014 Giro d'Italia. So that's one to look out for. I think that's going to be pretty special.
What have we got coming up tomorrow, Lionel?
Stage 11, we're in Tuscany, Daniel, aren't we? And we are
We graze Tuscany for the purposes of our wine.
We're drinking a very nice bottle of wine, I believe, when we get to Tuscany.
You say that as if it may already be open and breathing and slipping down your neck
yeah,
already.
I don't know why you get that sense, Lionel, but I do as well. It's almost, it's eerie that I also get that sense. I don't know what it is.
I just held the bottle up in front of a well-known wine app and saw that it was quite expensive.
Oh, nice.
very unsophisticated. But, you know,
anyway, the episode itself will be an interview with Max Chiandri, a very familiar voice to podcast listeners, especially at the Giro, because he tends to be a sports director at the Giro, most recently for Movistar and Richard Carapaz last year. But Max Chiandri, son of Tuscany, son of Derby, son of Los Angeles, we'll find out all about that.
Son of friend of Robert De Niro.
Indeed, yes. Well, we'll find out what the link between Max Chiandri and Robert De Niro is. And it's a sort of a lunch with interview, but done over the phone, of course, because we can't go anywhere at the moment, or we couldn't when I conducted that interview.
I mean, it's a great listen. I don't want to spoil it, but it did struck me at the start of the interview, Lionel, that Max had just dropped his three-year-old son off his bike. He'd just fallen off the back of his bike, and Max seemed quite grateful to have a diversion from picking up the pieces from that.
I think that's a
napalm
fair point, yeah.
And napalm, you and I must be very careful tomorrow, because we're starting in Umbria and Trevi, and we're going past Assisi. Last time we were in that area, we had a bit of trouble with the old bill, didn't we? And you know, they never contacted us, they never followed up their investigation following the infamous police raid in Assisi on our hotel in 2018. But tomorrow they might spy their opportunity, and we might have our collars felt.
Until tomorrow, thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Stay safe, chaps, stay safe.
Putting us out again tonight, again, is our friend Francois Thomazeau with his tribute, his musical tribute, to Lionel Burney's much missed Outside the Team Bus feature.
This is a song for Lionel, and it's inspired by his Outside the Bus series that everybody remembers. It's called Team Bus. Team Bus, what day is there? I say, please come back tomorrow. Team Bus, bus goes, he says, I go, please come back tomorrow. All that summer we enjoyed it, wind and rain and shine. That recorder, we never used it, by August it was gone. Every morning I would see him waiting at the bus. He'd make a fuss and he would show me what he thought. Other people stared as if we were both quite insane. Sometimes he called me names, which really was a shame. That's the way the whole thing started, silly but it's true. Of how he departed without an interview. Came the sun, the ice was melting, no more sheltering now. Sad to think that interview led us to a row. Every morning I would see him waiting at the bus. He'd make a fuss and he would tell me what he thought. Other people stared as if we were both quite insane. Sometimes he called me names, it really was a shame. Team Bus, what day is there? I say, please come back tomorrow. Team Bus, bus goes, he stays, I go, please come back tomorrow. All that summer we enjoyed it, wind and rain and shine. That recorder, we never used it, by August it was gone. Cheers, Lionel, I hope you liked my little song.